KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today. Today I'm very happy to have on one return guest and one new guest who I've wanted to have on for quite a while. Fred Stutzman, return guest, currently a visiting associate professor, at the School of Information and Library Science at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Woody Hartzog, assistant professor of law, Cumberland School of Law at Samford University, and like me, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Woody and Fred have drafted an article, which is not currently available publicly, but will be available soon, and if anyone wants a copy of the article, they can email the authors, and I'll give that information later in the show. They've drafted an article called Obscurity by Design. And this article follows on a topic that we've discussed with some regularity on Hearsay Culture, the lingering question of privacy as it relates to technology. And when we think about privacy online, of course, we run into an immediate conflict because, by definition, when you use the Internet, you are usually communicating with others, or at a minimum, others may have access to the information you provide on the Internet, and yet people often do not want to actually share everything that they put on the Internet with everyone, or share information through the Internet with every single person that may also be connected to the Internet. And so the lingering question that anyone who uses social media, which recent numbers suggest is as most of you, know, we have a lingering problem of what those privacy standards should be. Or, as Fred and Woody would say, should we think about it as privacy by design or obscurity? And that's going to be the focus of our discussion today. Obscurity by design is an interesting concept that kind of takes the privacy debate and attempts to fine-grain it to actually address the problems that are being faced in the world of social media in particular, but that are not well defined or perhaps well analyzed or as thoroughly analyzed by the normal use of the word privacy. And this sounds fairly abstract, and at a theoretical level I suppose it is, but we're going to be talking with Fred and Woody today about the practical implications of what obscurity by design would be. In other words, how can we protect privacy online by designing software and rethinking technology in a way that more accurately assesses what actual privacy concerns people have and how technology might get at them. And so we're going to be discussing today both the law as well as the technological design aspects of this issue, which is why having both Fred and Woody on at the same time is so terrific because, and as this article reflects, Fred has an expertise in the technology associated here, and we're not going to be talking at the level of coding, but at the technological level, what we actually can do with technology and how technology might in fact reflect the law that Woody's going to be focusing on and the social mores or social constructions that exist online, which we'll be discussing with both Fred and Woody. So both of them are joining us via Skype today, and I am thanking them as we're recording the show on August 3rd for airing on August 7th. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, gentlemen. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely.
Fred, let's start off. I'll start with you, Fred, and I'll ask the same question of Woody. Tell me a bit more about your background. And we talked about this the last time when I had you on discussing some of the interesting applications you've written to shut down social media when you simply don't want access to it. But let's focus a bit more on your background as it relates particularly to this question of privacy or as Woody and you call it, obscurity.
Right. Yeah. So I have been working in technology throughout my career. I was a technologist working in industry before I went to graduate school. I went to graduate school at the School of Information and Library Science at UNC Chapel Hill, where I now teach. At the school, I became interested in what people were doing in online social spaces, and particularly what they were sharing in online social spaces. As you know, we recall the when Facebook and MySpace and when all sorts of social media became popular, we got very interested in why people were sharing what they were sharing and what are the implications for privacy. And as a result of that, that's led to a multi-year study, a lot of collaboration with Woody, such as the paper reflected here, looking at number one, what people are doing in regards to online privacy, what they're sharing, why they're sharing, and then really taking a sociological lens to understand how to help people achieve their privacy goals through the design of better technology. And really, that's the crux. We're looking at, you know, my research looks at how to help people share in a way that's going to let them take best advantage of the affordances of these sites, let them use the sites to make their lives better, but let them use the sites in a privacy-enhancing way. And I think that that's really the crux, and that's how my background and my interests come together to realize the work we're doing today.
And Woody?
I first became interested in privacy law as part of when I was a clerk at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and I've been thinking about it ever since, in 2004. And privacy law, as you know, can be at times a hot mess. And one of the main things that I think we've yet to resolve is this issue of privacy in public and semi-public settings, and particularly online. So as we begin to socialize more online, moving from things like message boards to a much more robust and nuanced interaction online, and as we kind of port more of our social existence online, I became fascinated with how privacy, and particularly privacy law, was going to respond to this. And that's when I met Fred back in 2008, and he and I began to try to explore privacy within this new medium that was inherently social, that has now become known as social media. And we started digging around and doing some empirical work, and that's really how we came to this line of research.
With regard to the two of you working together, I mean, again, I think it's interesting. Perhaps you could talk about how you complement each other, and particularly for the benefit of the listeners, how you overlap perhaps on the issues of social mores. So, Woody, I'll start with you and just ask you, you know, in terms of working with Fred and collaborating, because this is not the only article that you've written with him, perhaps you could talk a little bit about how you work together substantively.
Sure. Fred and I I've really enjoyed working with Fred because as an information scientist and someone who really understands a number of different methodologies, Fred and I were able to attack this issue of privacy, which is, of course, you know, multidisciplinary in and of itself. There are legal privacy issues and social privacy issues and, you know, normative and sociological and psychological privacy issues. We were able to use a number of different methods to try to get at this problem. And so Fred brings a wonderful perspective of someone who understands not only the literature, the sociological and psychological literature behind a lot of this stuff, but also he knows the methods in which to attack it. And that really led to the reason that obscurity became an interesting issue for us is the very first study that we actually did dealt with social media users that had multiple profiles. We were very interested in this idea. So, as you know, a number of people that have Twitter accounts have two different accounts, one for personal use and one for professional use, or they have a social media account that they use, they have a Facebook account that they use for one purpose, and they have a MySpace or MySpace anymore, or Twitter or Flickr account that they use for some other purpose. And we were fascinated with why there was this normative distinction in mediums. And so we did a lot of research, and we asked a lot of questions with respect to, you know, how do you use this? Why do you use this? And we identified four different methods, four different kind of utilities that came from this boundary regulation. And one of those, and the thing that they kept on popping up over and over in our research, was that people didn't necessarily consider what they posted on social media to be a secret. That is, you know, multiple people knew it. Way too many people knew it for you to you know, legally or normatively consider it a secret. But they still felt like it was safe, and they didn't want certain people or the public at large to see it. And this was there was this theme that arose over and over, and the word that Fred and I eventually ascribed to that was obscurity. That was the only thing that it could be, is this reliance on obscurity to protect their information. And so that then led to a second article called The Case for Online Obscurity that's forthcoming in the California Law Review, where we tried to put forth a theory of online obscurity and how the law might respond to that.
And so let's get into that, because that gets us to the draft article we're discussing today. And I think you started there, Woody, and so perhaps I'll go back to Fred and ask and continue the question by saying up front, what is the difference between privacy as we understand it and obscurity as you define it? And Fred, I know that question both has technical, social, and legal ramifications. I'll ask you on a technical side first, what is the difference and what are they?
I think we can get to the technical understanding by stepping back and thinking about how people actually approach their protection of privacy. And basically, as Woody was talking about, we really did start this project from empirical research. We sat down, we did a qualitative study, we talked to a lot of people, did very in-depth interviews, and we tried to understand how people are actually approaching privacy. And what we found was surprising in some ways, but also not, because if we look at privacy from a hardline definition, if we think of privacy more as secrecy, as purely keeping things within, sharing with a very selective community, there's some of that going on. And certainly in every day, we have secrets, we have disclosures that we only share with a small group of people. But social media, the affordance of social media, what makes social media great is the fact that we are sharing with larger groups. We're sharing with 100 friends or 500 friends, or if you're a college student, 1,000 friends. You're putting information out there in ways that you never could put information out there before. We just never had the speed and the fidelity and the reach that's been afforded by these technologies. And so when we think about how people might adapt their sharing, their disclosures to these new realms, we realize that the traditional notions of privacy and the traditional notions of secrecy and sharing that are built for the offline world, so to speak, they're challenged by the affordance of these spaces. And so what we see and what we observed in our research and what we're trying to push forwards with our design and policy agenda is a more nuanced understanding of how people may think of sharing to a selective audience. And so I think, you know, maybe in the past we would say something that's shared to 100 people, that can't be a secret. That can't be private. That has to be public information. I mean, you know, if you're putting something out there to that wide an audience, why would you ever expect any privacy protections? But when we talk to people, when we look at use, when we see this in a number of studies, not just our studies, but across studies, we see that people expect a sense of privacy even though they're sharing to wide audiences. And so what we're seeing is an adaptation of privacy to the space. And I think this is just normal. This is just natural. We have seen our understandings of privacy change through interaction with technologies, things like CCTV surveillance, things like online records. I mean, we are constantly adjusting our operationalizations of privacy, our definitions of privacy, and we're doing it once again. And what's interesting about social media, what I think really draws us in, is the fact we're sharing within very large groups, but we're also expecting privacy. We're also expecting some degree of protection to the information that we're sharing within these groups. And, you know, getting back to how privacy is changing and how we're starting to approach privacy, we're looking at how are people actually, what strategies are they employing to protect privacy when the things that you're sharing sort of inherently are going to very big audiences. So it's not only why would people expect privacy when they're sharing to 100 or 1,000 people? But how would people produce privacy to share to a smaller subset of individuals within that 100 or 1,000 people? And we found evidence for both of these things. And I think it points to our understanding of obscurity and our analysis of obscurity is sort of how we came to understand how people are employing these strategies. They are using obscurity to protect their disclosures.
So Woody, is it fair or is it too simplistic to say that obscurity, as you're defining it, is this middle ground between absolute secrecy, where no one knows anything in particular about a given topic that you're trying to keep from the public, and you know the proverbial standing on the street and shouting at the top of your lungs?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. That's the way that we envision obscurity, is as this continuum. So if secrecy is the most important, most sensitive information, that if it were disclosed would be devastating, confidentiality is kind of, you know, the step up past that. So, you know, it's disclosed to a group of people, but there are still limits on how far it can go. And then there's this extremely broad spectrum of obscurity. And then there's kind of this idea of complete obviousness or complete publicity, which is the other end of the spectrum. And there's a lot in the middle that the law has just ignored or just taken a completely unnuanced approach to. So, you know, they'll say, is it protected by a password? It's a secret. Is it not? It's completely public. And that's really using a blunt tool when a scalpel could, I think, get at a much better result, both legally, because I think that reflects our normative expectations of privacy.
So, if we take this continuum from secret to confidential to obscure to publicity, nowhere in that is the word private, as you've defined it, Woody. And I think that's the focus of your article, and so that's what I want to focus on next, and remind listeners that you're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. We're chatting with Fred Stutzman of Chapel Hill, as well as Professor Woody Hartzog of Stanford Law School, Cumberland. What does that idea mean, right? If we have the idea of privacy that is not doing the job, as it were, where is the issue? Because your article seems to suggest that with regard to thinking about these issues from or through the prism of privacy, we don't get at the problems or the issues that you're seeking to address here. So let me start with that first question. Why is the word privacy inadequate? And Woody, I'll ask you that question.
Sure. Privacy has become so convoluted as to be almost meaningless as a useful term of art in the law. So the idea that, you know, we have never been able to settle on a definition of privacy. And so the idea that the law can then use that word as a tool is kind of ridiculous. And so I think that the much better approach is to throw out privacy as this kind of hardline legal concept and have it act as more of an umbrella term that represents lots of different things. And there are lots of privacy scholars that have argued the same thing. And that allows you to then isolate the problem. Is this a problem of breach of confidentiality? Is this a problem where it's actually a security problem and we call it privacy because the two are kind of related in certain ways? Or is this a question of appropriation? I mean, the idea that, you know, that our publicity rights and our right of appropriation kind of get molded into this right of privacy that we have in the United States just convolutes it even more. And so our idea with obscurity was to kick the word privacy out of it entirely, because whenever you invoke that word into a situation where you're sharing with people, the immediate response is going to be, you can't claim privacy because you're sharing it with other people. You're sharing it with lots of people. This idea is entrenched in the law. It's entrenched in Fourth Amendment doctrine. It's entrenched in tort law. And the best way to resolve this tension because we see this tension all the time, and people claim privacy, and yet the law doesn't recognize it, is to dump the word entirely. And it means too many things, and at this point, it's not helpful. Whereas obscurity is a term that has existed for quite some time, but the law has almost completely ignored it. There are a few cases that mention the term obscurity here and there, but it certainly has never been embraced as a real legal concept in all but a few cases.
So, you know, Fred, you know, as Woody's talking about the use of the word privacy and trying to change the semantics to focus on obscurity, you know, I'm reminded of Richard Stallman, who very famously is well known as the founder of the free software movement, and you know, there, you know, in some ways, you know, the father, if you will, of the whole idea of open source, and he has, you know, said numerous times that he's against the phrase intellectual property. And I'm curious whether your and Woody's critique of the word privacy is similar to Stallman's rejection of the phrase intellectual property, because to simplify Stallman's view he doesn't believe that what we call intellectual property should actually be property, or is that mm-hmm. stating the case too strongly from a technological perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think. From both of the angles that Woody and I are coming from to this project, privacy is a very value-laden and sensitive word, and we wanted to be very explicit in the terms that we were using. So, in a sense, the sense of privacy, sort of the end goal of a lot of this work, is in a sense to help users. Help everyday people use these technologies in a way that helps them achieve their privacy goals. Okay, so using that very broad umbrella term of whatever privacy means to you, but in our writing, in our discussion, and in both the technological and legal angles, we had to be very careful about what privacy is, because privacy in technology is very similar to the law in that it is often thought of as an absolute. And when approaching privacy from a computing standpoint, it gets quite challenging, because privacy becomes something that is binary. Privacy becomes simply a case switch of is something private, yes or no. And really, this is how we see some of the challenges emerge in design. When we think about how privacy is thought of in a interface within social media, you know, how do you manage your privacy within Facebook? Well, you go to a screen, you click a bunch of buttons that are yes or no's, binaries, and that is your privacy. Well, in reality, privacy is much more nuanced than that. And so we wanted to be very careful about how we discussed privacy and how we framed this definition of obscurity, because I think uniformly are thinking of it not as a binary, but as a continuum, and obscurity does this very nicely. So, you know, when we were collaborating on this, we were both coming to the problem from the very same angles of the way in which these words are these words are used. Well, we agree with the sense of them, and to a certain extent, when you're pushing, you know, when you're publicizing, when you're trying to make the case for users, we do have to use these words. We do have to use words such as privacy, but we do have to be careful about how we use them in this paper, because they are very value-laden terms. So we still believe in privacy in the sense of how our sense of privacy, but we wanted to move away from getting sort of caught up in the semantics of the privacy term in this paper.
And let me, before we take a very quick break, let me ask you this follow-up question, Fred. So if we're thinking about these issues from a practical perspective, I'll ask you this kind of broad state of the internet type question, which I know could take the rest of the show. But you coming at this from a technological perspective, what would you say is the state of the average internet user's obscurity online today? Is that a question that we can currently assess, or do we need to do more work to define what it means?
This is we actually did take this on in the first paper, and a common, you know, I think the common sense understanding or the guess would be that most people on the internet are not obscure, you know, but my. And you know what we were arguing in this paper is that obscurity actually is very common. So if you think about the average user, where their who their audience is of whatever it is they're posting, there are certain laws of the internet. These are things like power laws, distributions in large scale network systems. These things have been proven in the physics literature and the computer science literature. We know that the average audiences of a lot of the things that are posted online are really quite small. When we use an internet technology, when we and we also know this from, you know, just talking to users, doing more sociological studies, a lot of times people use these technologies not to sort of publicize widely, but to actually interact with small groups of people. You know, so our argument was that people are actually a lot more obscure on the internet than one might expect. And because of that, we make this argument that obscurity is really sort of a natural state. Because if we were in a state where nothing was obscure online, when we had and we would post something and have lots of people responding to us, the systems would fall apart very quickly. In reality, there's only a small number of people who get that sort of attention, where they're way on the left side of the long tail distribution, in the sense of getting a lot of attention. Most of us are actually way more in the tail of this distribution of attention, and we're getting small audiences. So that. Using a couple of different literatures, we come to this argument of obscurity being something that is actually much more commonplace than people might expect.
We're chatting with Professor Woody Hartzog of Cumberland School of Law at Samford University, to be absolutely clear about that, having occasionally had people in the past refer to me as a professor at Stanford Law School and having to quickly correct them and say, no, I'm not a professor. And Woody is not a professor at Stanford, but rather at Samford in Alabama. And Fred Stutzman, visiting assistant professor at Chapel Hill. You are listening to KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to KZSU as well as to Hearsay Culture. You mentioned this literature, Fred, and Woody, I'll turn to you on this because I think, although both of you, I'm sure, would have a lot to say about it. Literally, your first footnote refers to the work of Ann Cavoukian, referring to an article that she authored a few years ago called Privacy by Design. And you mentioned her work repeatedly through this article as a cornerstone of the work you're doing. Before we get into the four principles of online obscurity that you've identified, which I think are fascinating, we can spend some time on each. Who is Ann Cavoukian, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, and how does her work impact the work that you're doing now?
I'll actually turn to Fred on that
one. Oh, okay, fair enough.
Okay, sure. So Ann Cavoukian is the privacy commissioner in Ontario, I believe. So she's in Canada. And she has been working on what she calls privacy by design for probably almost 20 years. And so what privacy by design is, it's something that we're hearing a lot about now, but she's been working on it for quite some time, so we have to give a lot of credit there. Cavoukian is interested in implementing FIPS, which are fair information practices, into the design of technologies. So she wants to actually bring the privacy into design. And really, that's why she calls privacy by design. So if you think about the alternate case where privacy is an afterthought, privacy is a series of settings that you throw in after you've designed your project, what Cavoukian wants us to do, the essence of her argument, is she wants privacy to be built into the design process of technology. And so we've been hearing a lot about privacy by design because both the EU and the US regulators, the FTC and the EU privacy commissioners, have turned to privacy by design as a way to potentially address the increasing privacy conflicts in the design of large-scale social media technologies, large-scale data mining, large-scale data warehousing. And the commissioners in both EU and US are moving towards privacy by design potentially being, well, being a guideline and a best practice for how to approach the design of technology, but also potentially being a remedy, potentially being a something that is used as a punishment. So, you know, it isn't there yet, but it's something that the regulators are thinking about. And so so that's privacy by design. To get a little bit more into the detail, Kevorkian has sort of 9 guidelines for how it should be utilized. But really, the key essence is thinking about, in her words, privacy being designed into a technology as it is being built, and that being something that is both a win for the people who are building the technology and the users of the technology.
And it, you know, it's very interesting because you take her work and the work of some others to come up with these principles of online obscurity, which are interesting because they are factors that you've identified that presumably if all of those factors existed, you wouldn't have obscurity. In other words, you would have, in fact, publicity. And so you've identified these 4 factors that you say are essential to discovery or comprehension of information on the internet. And what you wrote, at least in the draft, if you don't mind me quoting at least a couple of sentences, recognizing that this is a draft, you write that the proper metaphor in thinking about obscurity by design is the key and lock to possess context. The keys are keys that render the information unobscure or obvious. And if we think about this idea of obscurity as not having the keys or locks to get to understanding and accessing information, I think this becomes the kind of fine-grained analysis that you want to do. So Woody, in the article you've identified 4 factors: search visibility, unprotected access, identification, and clarity. And it, from a legal perspective, and I know that this is another question that could take the rest of the show, so let me tailor it very specifically because I want to discuss the technology in a moment. But from a legal perspective, what are each of these ideas? And then my follow-up question after you've answered that is talking a bit about the law around them. But let's start identifying what these terms mean. So what is search visibility?
Sure. So much of our concept of obscurity depends on kind of how you implement it. So are you implementing this as part of an agreement, or are we going to kind of bake this into the reasonable expectations of privacy test, or are we going to make this some kind of regulatory standard? And so keeping in mind that our answer would likely be contoured to the specifics of the question that was asked, generally we call these 4 factors of obscurity non-exclusive, so we're not ruling out that there are more. We just identified 4 in our research. And the first and perhaps most important is search visibility. The idea is that if you're dead to Google, then you're really kind of dead to the world if you can't be found with Google. And so much of what we see with privacy harms potentially occurs with Googling someone's name. So we all know the instances about when you apply for a job, someone Googles your name and the picture of you holding that beer or the joint shows up, and all of a sudden you don't have the job anymore. But, and maybe surprisingly, most of the information on the internet is not searchable by general purpose search engines. They call this the dark web, and estimates are anywhere from 70 to 90% of all online information is hidden from search engines. And so that's a really big factor in obscurity because it prevents you from finding information. So if you conceptualize obscurity as the inability to either find or understand information, then clearly the inability to find it via a search engine means that the only way that you're going to get it is if someone else shares it with you or you have some knowledge about where to find it. And then, of course, probabilistically, the odds of that are very low.
And let me, before you go on there, Woody, because that's an interesting statistic you've mentioned. When you're talking about 79% of information not being findable via search engine, what you're saying is that Google, to be clear, has not indexed that information. But am I right? You may be able to find a web page that if you had access to the contents of that web page, or let's say a bank or something like that, you would then have access to information. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that actually leads into the second factor of online obscurity, which is unprotected access.
Right.
And those two work together in many different ways. So a perfect example is information that is hidden by privacy settings on Facebook. It's this idea that if you'll notice, if you type someone's name in that has utilized Facebook's privacy settings, you may be able to find their public profile, but there's not any information behind it. And that's because Google doesn't index that information because it's password protected. And so everything that's protected by a password is not able to be found by Google's searching by their crawlers, and so that's right. And the Google also respects the robot.txt file, and so if you plant that on your site, there's no real access restrictions. It just doesn't show up when you search for it on Google. And now you've actually seen a number of social media entities that are offering the option of keeping, for example, your blog off of search engines. When you create a Tumblr account, Tumblr gives you the option of having Google list it, or if you create a blog via Blogger, there's this little checkbox that says, do you want us to index this blog or not? And that's a wonderful way of creating some obscurity by saying, no, I don't want anyone to find this blog.
And so just to give the overview there, the last two factors, which again, I mean, they're all interrelated, identification and clarity.
Right. So these are the trickier aspects because they deal with understanding rather than finding. So the first two factors deal with finding information. Is it visible through search engines, and can you access it without any kind of either network connection or a password, which is unprotected access? And of course, that's one of the greatest creators of obscurity online as well. Those are the two most dominant, powerful, and clear-cut factors. So there's less ambiguity there. With search visibility, you either can find it via general purpose search engines, or typically you can't, and there's not a lot of nuance there. You can say the same for unprotected access. Identity or identification deals with how well you are identifiable, right? So you can use your full name, which would be completely identified, or you could use just your first name. So if there's a photo of me on the internet, and the tag on it just says Woody, then that's more obscure than if it had Woodrow Partzog, which is, of course, my full name. And I could use my initials, so WH, or I could use just the first word, W, or I could use a pseudonym. I'm, awesome rocker guy. And so that's something that is a way to create obscurity by using pseudonyms that keep you, your real identity, I suppose, whatever that is, which... And there are lots of people that say that's a social construction anyway, a secret. And then clarity is the most complex and difficult to pin down of the four obscurity factors. Clarity is whether someone can understand what it is, fully understand within context what it is that they just saw. And I'll give an example. Let's say that I post on my Facebook page the following status update. Got a positive result from the test with an exclamation point. Now, unless you knew that my wife was taking a pregnancy test, you would have no idea what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say I was going in to get tested for some kind of disease and only a few people knew that, and I post on my Facebook status page, got a negative result. Well, my friends that knew that I was concerned about the test would all be relieved, and that post would make no sense to anyone else. And so that's a lack of clarity. And the less clear content is, the more obscure it becomes, because the lower likelihood that anyone will actually understand it. Dana Boyd calls this hiding in plain sight, or steganography.
Right.
And it's something that you can utilize to create obscurity. security. So if you conceptualize this as something that users can do to increase their privacy online and sharing environments, muddying up the clarity of something is a way to produce obscurity. And I think that, users, perhaps even without realizing it, engage in this kind of activity all the time.
Before I go back, to Fred, Woody, on that last point, clarity, which I agree is challenging, but to push back a little bit, unless and I'll take your Facebook example, unless this is your first post on Facebook, there's always quite a bit of contextual information. So, got a positive test, test result, exclamation point. Most people, or correct me if I'm wrong, I would assume most people using Facebook are not going to post that information, meaning, now I've got some horrific disease. In other words, it's likely to be good news. Now, of course, there are people that use Facebook to bare their souls, in which case it could mean anything. But I guess my question is this. When you talk about clarity, again, from the perspective of obscurity by design, is it fair to say that we're talking about, or you're talking about, absolute clarity? In other words, the moment that anything is even remotely ambiguous, and depending on, your perspective, everything is ambiguous, but the moment that you step away from absolute clarity, are you in the obscurity world?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, you may be on the tail end of it, but that's the beauty of a continuum, mm-hmm. is okay. that it's one of many factors to consider. And if everything else makes complete sense, then it's only 0.1% obscure and almost completely obvious. Mm-hmm. And so unless you combine that with something that's not visible by search and protected by passwords and also, posted under a pseudonym, then it will remain pretty much completely obvious. Mm-hmm. But the idea that this is just one of many pieces, I think, helps us understand on a bigger level how to implement this. And to mm-hmm. to push back on your point about that no one would post whether they had a disease or not on Facebook, you're probably right about that. But another point that we try to make in the article, in both of our articles, that obscurity is not this cure-all for all of our privacy problems. There's some information that absolutely still should be protected by things like confidentiality or very robust laws that keep things secret. Obscurity is often a kind of good enough privacy protection or good enough for most kinds of information. But there are lots of seemingly innocuous posts that could still be used against you. For example, the report about the woman who was receiving benefits from her employer for depression. She was going to see a therapist and she was on medication. Then all of a sudden the benefits stopped coming. And when she inquired why, the insurance company responded and said, "Well, you look far too happy for anyone that is depressed. And so we've decided that you're cured." And so that was information that was taken out of context and decontextualized against her, that when she posted it was probably seemingly innocuous. I mean, it was just, like vacation photos and pictures of her smiling. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult to predict how information can be used against you. And so I think that's still, the clarity is still an important factor of obscurity.
We're chatting with Fred Stutzman of University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Information and Library Science, as well as Professor Woody Hartzog of Crumlin School of Law at Stanford University on KZSU FM Stanford. And KZSU in particular would be particularly interested in pointing out that this is a public broadcast. And I'll repeat again, please make donations. I don't normally make a plea twice in one show, but I'm doing that now in particular because I think it's important to recognize how much funding goes into keeping the station going. So a slightly abrupt segue to come back to Fred to talk on the technological side. Fred, with regard to the technological aspects of implementing these four factors, let me ask you a broad question, and I'll recognize up front that this is now what I call the unfair portion of the show, when I ask questions that you no longer have an adequate amount of time to answer as completely as you might like, but I use the host prerogative and ask a question anyway. Let me ask this broad question. Do design folks get these ideas. In other words, we know that, in fact, there is a need for this analysis because clearly the word obscurity and the concept of obscurity, even if it's thought about, has not been identified, and I think your work is valuable there. But if we take this down to a design and coding level, do, first of all, and up front, coders and designers get these ideas? Are these ideas already floating around in the technological world but not thought in these terms, or is there some other state of affairs?
Mm-hmm. So I would say absolutely. There are certainly designers who understand this. Our piece, you know, and pushing this forward doesn't say that this kind of valuable thinking hasn't been done. Perhaps the contribution of this piece and where we move from privacy by design to obscurity by design is realizing that designing for privacy in any sort of technological system is not just a design problem. It's really a problem that brings multiple stakeholders to the table. So not only do you have designers, you've got your product managers, you've got your staff policy, you've got your government regulators, you've got the business interests. Basically, you've got a number of people who are interested in how privacy is realized in technology. And so in pushing away from, say, just pure privacy by design to obscurity by design, what we're trying to do is give all of these stakeholders a central metaphor from which to work from that will help, that will then be something that can be designed and understood and used by the people that are using the technology. So really, we're using this as a way to potentially address the sort of multifaceted nature of the problem of design, realizing that it's not just a design issue, it's all sorts of stakeholders.
And therefore, the follow-up question would be, of the ways that one could implement obscurity by design, which immediately is the most technologically feasible?
Well, I've been thinking about this from how would we actually implement obscurity by design without designing any technology.
Oh, there so you go.
Going back to our very first study, which was the study of multiple profile maintainers, in that study, we realized a number of ways in which people were utilizing obscurity without actually pushing any technological buttons, so to speak. So people using name variants, as Woody was talking about earlier, that's a very real strategy. Using things like name variants, using things like secondary profiles, you're not generating a new technology to have a new profile. But these are things that are available to users but are oftentimes restricted by policy. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Facebook, for example, using a name, any other name than your real name, is prohibited by the terms of service. Using a secondary account is prohibited by the terms of service. And just yesterday in the news, Facebook changed their estimate of how many users in Facebook were using multiple profiles, for example. They found that somewhere along 8-9% of all Facebook users had a secondary profile. Whether that be for spamming or for actually protecting yourself as an obscurity measure, that we're not quite sure of that. But we know that people are using these technologies and without any design. So that's sort of the simplest way. But you know, in the paper, we propose a number of potential solutions, things that are very potentially quite complex, like selective access control of technology, of posts, to things that are maybe less complex, involving policy interventions, maybe allowing, designing policy in ways that allows users to, within the rules of the policy, take on and use their obscurity, use their sort of natural obscurity protections. A lot of times that's limited within these technologies.
And Woody, you know, that what Fred just said is interesting, is from a legal perspective, what I hear Fred saying is there are simple ways to do this, But in order to do implement those simple solutions, you need to hack the system. You need to be willing to violate terms of service. You need to be doing other things that could get you into trouble, at least privately, with a given provider, to go a step further and actually bake this idea into the technology would require social media companies and other portals to actually agree that this, in fact, is a value structure that should be implemented. And obviously, it goes without saying that Facebook generally will make, you know, more money the more information is not private. So from a legal perspective, do you feel like the law is adequately situated, as it were, to allow those kinds of non-breaching behaviors to actually be baked into a Facebook?
This is the tough question, and I think that this is something we've thought about over the past couple of months, and the answer is there are several ways you could go about it, but the most promising one seems to be giving incentives to engage in obscurity-friendly policies, right? So if the FTC is going to come out and say, we would like for social media companies to be, you know, have obscurity-friendly practices, and if you're going to, you know, claim that you engage in obscurity by design, then these are the certain kinds of things that you need to do. And perhaps if you engage in obscurity by design, then that gives you some kind of liability, you know, shield or immunity from accusations of unfair design, where you can come back and say, listen, here's what we've done. We've allowed users to, in, you know, easily invoke privacy settings. We don't have in our policies restrictions on multiple profiles or pseudonyms. I mean, you see Google Plus has engaged in this, where they allowed certain kinds of name variants. You know, we've allowed, you know, certain kinds of encryption or, you know, it's just really more secrecy than obscurity, but it's a way to control access. And you can bake things into the design. So a lot of what we get into in the paper is this idea that privacy is often buried at the very bottom of social media companies, or it's really hidden. So any suggestion of privacy is you've got to have 17 clicks before there's any mention of it. On a social utility where privacy is probably a pretty big deal. And so maybe you introduce privacy at the outset. You bake it into the language that you use when signing up users and instructing them and showing them how to use their product. Because there's a fair amount of literature that says that simple little changes like that can have a big deal in sharing. And I'd like to push back on this idea that reducing or increasing obscurity, if privacy is conceptualized as obscurity, is not in the interest of social media companies. Fred and I have found that obscurity is actually essential to socialization, and that the more obscurity is provided for users, then you can actually increase the amount of sharing that goes on. And so I think that it would be a mistake for social media companies to come right out and say, well, obscurity is bad for business. Because we would actually argue that it's great for business in the sense of users will want to use your service more. Look at how many people use pseudonyms on Twitter or have multiple accounts, some of which are public and protected and some of or unprotected, and some of which are private and protected. And so we would argue that obscurity is great for business.
Well, let me, you know, this is, I'm going to pull a, you know, Chris Matthews or Bill O'Reilly move right now, Woody, and do a quick follow-up and then tell you have 10 seconds to respond, because we are running out of time. I don't normally do this, but as a sign of respect, I'm going to push back quickly and say, isn't that point true only because as people are currently socialized, they're not yet fully comfortable with the kind of publicity that Facebook would, in fact, want in an ideal world, but that if I'm Facebook, I'm going to keep pushing people in that direction until they get to the point where they don't need as much obscurity as they currently think they do?
Yes, I think that's true, but I think that that would involve a lot of deception. I think that would involve, because I think that there's a threshold where ultimately people are going to be uncomfortable, even if it's pushed on technology bounds. They're going to feel uncomfortable socializing. So I don't want to talk about how much – I don't want to gossip if it's going to be completely public, right? So much of gossip is only effective because we figure the person we're gossiping about isn't going to hear about it. Mm-hmm. And if Facebook had their way, then they would blast it to everyone. And so I think that in order to get to Facebook's ideal world of complete publicity, it's going to involve deception. This is where the law has to come in. And that's my 10-second response.
There you go. Well, that was more than 10 seconds, but I won't edit your answer out once we have the show. The draft article is Obscurity by Design. The author is Fred Stutzman, visiting assistant professor at the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Professor Woody Hartzog, assistant professor of law at Cumberland School of Law at Samford University, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Gentlemen, the article is not on SSRN, but you've mentioned that people are welcome to email for a draft of the article. Who should they email, and what is the email address? You right on the spot and say who's going to get the emails.
Feel free to email me. My email address, this is Fred. You can email me Fred@FredStutzman, FredStutzman.com, and I will be happy to send a copy of the article out.
And I'm happy to send one too as well.
Yeah,
very good. And Woody is W Hartzog, HARTZOG at Samford, SAMFORD.EDU. Gentlemen, thank you for joining today on Hearsay Culture. I'm a fan of your work. I look forward to having you both back on the show as you continue to work through this problem. And I look forward to seeing the word obscurity increasing in our discussions about these incredibly important issues involving what information is known about us online. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be on.
Yes, thank you, Dave. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Let me mention for the remaining portion of the quarter who is coming up on KZSU. And I should note that the show is being recorded on August 3rd for airing August 7th. I do anticipate that this quarter's shows will be available by early next week. Over the summer, things tend to get posted a little bit more slowly than normal. But coming out for the remainder of the quarter, Professor Madhavi Sundar of UC Davis School of Law, author of the book From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Marcin D. Kaminski and Stefan Larsson of Lund University in Sweden on their work involving Pirate Bay. Professor Chris Sprigman of Virginia Law, co-author of the book The Knockoff Economy. And Professors Jeremy DeBeer and Chidi Agamanam of the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law discussing the Open Air Project. And Dr. Deborah Peel on health information privacy. We have a number of guests that are also going to be coming up for the fall quarter, but I'm in the process of contacting other potential guests for the show. So any comments, suggestions for future guests should be directed to me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.